You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're all in our own separate secret locations. No?
Helpful. Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, chaps. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter. We're speaking on Easter Monday, yeah.
Did you get an egg? Napalm? Big old egg?
Yes, I did get an egg. A Cadbury's cream egg. Other brands of chocolate are available, of course.
They get smaller and smaller, don't they, Cadbury's cream eggs?
Or is it that I'm getting bigger and bigger?
They're like, they'll be like quail's eggs next year. They get smaller and smaller. Yeah, but it could just be my hands getting bigger. I'm not sure. It's not backed up by any scientific evidence. No empirical data to support that. But anyway, well, we're speaking the day after the Amstel Gold Race. I'm just back from France and Belgium. Spent a lot of time in France the last couple of weeks where apparently Matthew van der Poel is French from the French commentary. They go on and on about his grandfather, Raymond Poulidor, and hardly mention his father, Audrey van der Poel. We'll be talking about Matthew van der Poel in this episode, no doubt. I was at Brabantse Peel, which he won, and we'll have an interview with Marc Sargeant, the Lotto Soudal boss, whose rider Victor Campenaerts broke the world hour record last week. And we'll hear from Mike Woods as well, who was riding the Amstel Gold Race and is looking ahead to Liège-Bastogne. Anything else? I think we've got 18 riders, Daniel, to look forward to competing or contending at Liège-Bastogne-Liège.
Yeah, that beloved feature is making a comeback this week.
Wonderful. That's lots to look forward to then. And Lionel, you're off to the Ardennes very soon, are you not?
I am, tomorrow morning, yes, going for Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège and trying to get under the skin of the Ardennes in a similar way to my trip to Flanders a couple of years ago. Looking forward to it. Going off with Simon, the photographer.
Ardennes mini break. It's lovely. Lovely time indeed of year for that. Well, news roundup, please, Lionel.
Thanks, Rich. Yeah, as you mentioned, we have a new hour record in the world of men's cycling. Victor Campenaerts, a Belgian rider who rides for Lotto Soudal, broke Bradley Wiggins' 2015 record, which was set in London, by 563 metres. Campenaerts' record was set in Mexico at altitude at Aguascalientes, 55.089 kilometres. So reigniting the race for the hour record, but Campenaerts is the new holder of that. As Richard said, we'll hear from Marc Sargeant, his trade team boss, a little bit later on. Sticking with Belgium, some very sad news that Patrick Surcoux has died, aged 74. Anyone who's been to the Ghent Six will recognise Surcoux. He is Mr. Ghent Six. He's organised the event for many years, was a legendary six-day rider in his own right, won more than anyone else, 88 in total, including 11 editions of the Ghent Six between 1965 and 1981. Partnering Eddie Merckx several times as well. In recent years, you know, he'd taken great pride in selecting the riders for the Ghent Six, picking well-matched partnerships and attracting big stars and putting on a six-day that really has endured and thrived recently. So sad news in Belgium. He also won an Olympic title in the kilometre at the Tokyo Games in 1964, several other world titles on the track, but also had a long road career, which perhaps overlooked slightly, won six stages of the Tour de France and the Green Jersey in 1974. As you mentioned, Rich, the Amstel Gold Race at the weekend, Matthew van der Poel, the Dutch champion, won in a pretty impressive style. We'll talk about that. Big victory for him, for Corendon Circus. He really was the ringmaster in the Netherlands at the weekend, wasn't he?
Think of how many circuses those Corendon boys must have sold today.
Yeah, great. Great day for business.
Is that what they sell pop-up circuses, do they?
I think actually, Lionel, it is. Or Corendon are a Turkish-Dutch airline company and Circus are a betting company, I think. Sadly.
I genuinely didn't know that until just now. Thank you for that. Anyway, we'll talk about how van der Poel won the race. It was the first Dutch victory since 2001. Can you remember who that was and who he beat?
Eric Decker. Did he beat the controversial Lance Armstrong in the sprint?
Was it not Bogart? Michael Bogart?
No, that was 1999, Rich.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Decker beat Armstrong in 2001, the last Dutch winner of the Amstel Gold Race. Well, the finish of the men's race was dramatic, but the finish of the women's race was arguably even more so. Certainly the last hour or so was absorbing. Won by Cassia Nieuwendomme of the Canyon-SRAM team. She attacked on the Coburg and held off Annemiek van Vleuten in the finishing straight. Marianne Vos sprinted in to take third place. Van der Poel's week was pretty extraordinary because a few days earlier at the race you were at, Richard, Brabantsepil, he out-sprinted a group including Julian Alaphilippe, Michael Matthews and Tim Wellens. Sophie de Vuist won the women's race there. There's been quite a bit of racing in France as well. Paris Camembert was won by AG2R's Benoit Cosnefroy. The Tour de Finistère in Brittany, won by Julian Simon of Cofidis. And Trobro-Leon, one of my favourite races, just because of how it looks and the landscape it takes in Brittany and the farm tracks, has been won in front of our very eyes. It's finished about 5 minutes ago as we speak, by Andrea Vendrame of Androni. The Tour of Turkey World Tour race was on this week as well. Two stage wins for Sam Bennett, one for Fabio Jakobsen and a couple for Caleb Ewan in the sprints. And the overall honours were taken by Bora Hansgrohe's Felix Grosschartner, who also won the most hilly stage of the race. The Tour of the Alps is underway. Theo Gegenhardt has won the opening stage for Team Sky this afternoon. That's his first victory as a professional. This is his third season with Team Sky, so he'll be in the leader's jersey when the race resumes again tomorrow. We also heard that Pascal Ackermann, who is Bora Hansgrohe's sprinter for the upcoming Giro d'Italia, crashed. Initially, there were reports that he'd fractured his arm, but not so, apparently. So he should be fit for the Giro, although he is out of the Tour of the Alps. A little bit of news regarding Rod Ellingworth, Team Sky's race coach. He is off to Bahrain Merida shortly, part of the McLaren investment in the team. And that's all in the cycling news, but a couple of bits of news from us. We've been nominated again for the British Podcast Awards. We've been nominated every year, haven't we? We've been a finalist every year in the sports category, but this year it's the cycling podcast Feminin that has been shortlisted for the final. So well done, Richard, Orla and Rose. Thoroughly deserved. Fingers crossed for you on May the 18th. But listeners, you can also vote for us in the Listener Award by going to britishpodcastawards.com/vote. So if you like the cycling podcast, vote for us, please.
Does that mean the buff is going to have to leave the Giro in the same way that you're leaving the Giro to go and watch Watford at the cup final?
I'm going to be home that weekend anyway, as good luck would have it. Lionel, are we splitting our vote here? Because people could vote for the cycling podcast or the cycling podcast Femina, could they? Am I right in thinking
I'm
that?
Not sure, because no, when you go on to the website, the British Podcast Awards.com website, you have to type in the name of the podcast you're voting for. And I mean, vote for any of our shows, really. If you like, you know, any of our shows, just vote for the cycling podcast. Don't split your vote.
Be safe and vote for the cycling podcast. We're all part of the same family, aren't we?
We are indeed. Just a little heads up for any listeners who want to contribute and help us put together our Giro d'Italia preview in a couple of weeks. The first episode of our Giro coverage a few days before the start in Bologna will be the return of our popular/unpopular press conference. So any listeners can send in their questions. Two ways to submit a question to us. You can either email us at contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, or you can preferably call our WhatsApp number and leave a voice message. The number is in our Twitter biography, but it is +44 797 133 8205. Please try and keep your questions succinct, you know, under a minute if you possibly can. And you can ask us anything about the Giro, this year's race. You can ask us to speculate wildly, ask us about the cuisine we'll be enjoying around Italy, the course, the favourites, the history. Try and trip Daniel up somehow, ask him something that he might struggle to answer, or at least has to research. And that will be, why not? That will be our episode or the week commencing May the 6th or 7th, whenever that is. And finally, just a plug for our three Friends of the Podcast specials that are out or imminent. Last week we released My Coffee with Patrick Lefevre, the De Koenig Quickstep boss. That is online now. And in a couple of days' time, Daniel, your special looking at the recoveries from very serious injuries by Austrian riders Marco Haller and Bernie Eisel will be online as well. And then next week, I'll be in the Ardennes for what I'm inevitably going to call the Lionel of the Ardennes.
Just finally, on the French specials, and you can sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. Thanks to everyone who's signed up, and thanks to those who've paid a little bit extra. If you do so, we will be asking you for your suggestions for a French special that you will then guest edit. We did this last year. It led to our How to Retire episode. We'll be doing that again this year. So if you're one of our higher donors, then you will be invited to submit an idea, and we will consider those at the Tour de France and then make a selection, as Sean Kelly might say. We'll be in touch on that. But thanks very much to everybody who signed up as a friend of the podcast.
The fastest clothing in the world tour. The home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Ratha in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
I really love my Ratha Bibshot because they have the best fit, individual fit, and I have a good feeling. I can ride my bike as long as I want. Hey, I'm Lisa Klein and I'm racing for Canyon SRAM. I think the most important thing is that they are pretty individual, so we can choose our chamois, the length. So yeah, it suits like a kind of second skin, and we have different fabrics for every temperature. So there's no excuse to don't ride your bike. I think the Ratha Bibshots are quite the best in the world.
Thanks very much indeed to our headline sponsor, Ratha. Now, Ratha are releasing, or this week in fact, the new Nelson Vales collection. Nelson Vales is a name that I certainly remember. Daniel, you're a little bit too young to remember. Lionel, you'll remember Nelson Vales.
Absolutely. Well, the 1984 Olympic Games in Los Angeles. He was silver medalist in the sprint behind Mark Gorski, I think, who later went on to be manager with the Motorola or US Postal team. This is testing my knowledge. It's quite a long time ago, and you've caught me on the hop a bit here, but that's who Nelson Vales is. Yeah,
he was also the first black rider ever to finish on the podium at the Olympic Games. A real kind of pioneer. He also had been a courier in New York City. His helmet at the LA Games had sort of decals of the New York, the Harlem skyline on the sides. And he was quite a figure. I've watched a couple of his match sprints from the Olympics. There was a lot of track standing in those days. You don't see so much of that these days. But yeah, a very impressive figure. He raced on the road as well, but a really rapid ascent to that silver medal at the Olympic Games in LA. The Ratha Nelson Vales collection, as I say, launches this week. It includes jersey, bibs, base layer, cap and socks. And his story is well worth looking up, as well as the kit that you'll find at ratha.cc. And don't forget also to follow EF Gone Racing, the Ratha films following EF Education First this season. A couple of recent releases from the Tour of Flanders, where Alberto Bettiol won, of course. And Paris-Roubaix, which is really worth watching. The heartbreak of Taylor Finney's non-finish and Sepp van Marck's near miss. He was fourth in the end, very, very emotional about that. So you can subscribe to Ratha Films at YouTube or go to ratha.cc to see the Nelson Vales collection and the EF Gone Racing films. So the Amstel Gold Race, chaps. A couple of tweets caught my eye on Sunday as the race was unfolding. One from our colleague, the televangelist Daniel Freib: the Vanderpool hype train if he wins today. And he included a little gif there of people crowding onto a train. And then a bit later on, also from televangelist Daniel Freib, got a feeling this is going to be a long week you're a Julian Alaphilippe non-fan. I know, but at that point, with Alaphilippe away with Jakob Fuglsang, as they were at Strada Bianca, of course, earlier in the year, it did look as though they had the race between them and that Alaphilippe would be the logical winner. So what happened?
They dilly-dallied, didn't they?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? I mean, I didn't watch this race live, so I was very aware of the reaction to it when I did watch it. And I don't know if that's, in this case, I don't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing. I did watch the women's race live, and I found that to be a fantastic race. And there's a lot going on in women's cycling at the moment with Annemiek van Vleuten and Anna van der Breggen perhaps not quite as dominant as they've been, and it's opening it up and making it really interesting and exciting. When I watched the men's race later on, and I knew the result, and clearly, you know, for the last 10 kilometres, it didn't look like that was going to be the result. So there was a real kind of wow factor in the eventual outcome. But was it one of the greatest races that we've ever seen, as I've seen some people claiming?
Napalm, do you want to take this hospital pass?
It is a hospital pass, isn't it? I mean, it was a fantastic finale, wasn't it? It really was. The last 3 or 4 kilometres and the way it all came together in the finish straight was amazing. It really, until sort of 43 kilometres to go, until Matthew van der Poel's attack or move on the Hulpenberg, which dragged Gorka Izagirre with him. I mean, that looked like a real tactical blunder. But he's got away with tactical blunders in several of the races this spring, van der Poel. It was just a staggering finale to see it all come together at the end. There was a point where it looked like Mikhail Kwiatkowski was going to get across the gap, and indeed did get across the gap, and then really joined up with the front two, Julian Alaphilippe and Jakob Fuglsang, too early, really. He was unfortunate in coming across a bit too early to do the classic jump through and try and win it from there. But as you say, Daniel, they did dilly-dally, the front two. Probably didn't have great information about what the time gap was. Thought they had a lot more to play with. Clearly didn't. But take nothing away from the commitment from van der Poel and the emotion of seeing the Dutch champion win in front of a home crowd. I mean, even just watching on the TV and having the knowledge of what that area is like on not just Amstel Gold Day, but I've also been there when the Tour de France has gone over the Coburg. You know, the atmosphere is absolutely electrifying anyway. When it was obvious to everyone that van der Poel had won it in the Dutch national champion's jersey, the cheer was like a goal had gone in at football. You know, it wasn't a cycling cheer. It was a really partisan cheer by a crowd that, you know, hasn't seen a Dutch winner winning that race for a long time. So, I mean, it was an absolutely astounding finale. But it's very difficult to say, is it the best race of all time? Because it was kind of a rerun, I guess, or a similar set of circumstances to the 1987 Liège-Bastogne-Liège, where Claude Criquillion and Stephen Roach were away in the finish in Liège on a flat finish in those days on the Boulevard de la Souvenir. And Moreno Argentina, who was the reigning world champion at the time, sprung a surprise, coming from behind, catching and going past them in the finish straight. And do we look at that as being the greatest race of all time, or do we look at that as being, you know, a kind of a surprise, an ambush, you know, a memorable one at that? But I think this race will go into that category in years to come. I don't know.
Just on the extent of the dilly-dallying, Napalm, people have been analysing the footage of the last 3 kilometres, and Alaphilippe and Fuglsang Road were the third to last kilometre, 37k an hour more or less, van der Poel 47, so almost 10k an hour quicker. Then it was Alaphilippe, 38.5 kilometres an hour to van der Poel's 51.8, so the second to last kilometre, and then the last kilometre, Alaphilippe was 52.94 and van der Poel 64. So you can kind of see there how it all came together. I think Alaphilippe, he'd crashed at the Tour of the Basque Country and had been out of action for a few days and maybe a little bit undercooked. It's pretty remarkable, if he is undercooked, that he was able to stick with Fuglsang and look as though he was going to win the race. But I think he was probably hanging on a bit. Fuglsang said that he was also complaining about being tired and, you know, saying he couldn't work too much. But then he'd also employed a similar tactic at Strade Bianche earlier in the year. As far as the excitement goes and how epic and how wonderful the race was, I mean, it's really in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? I mean, you know, a certain mood takes you when you're watching certain races, and people get carried away, but, you know, they're entitled to get carried away, and it's good that they do get carried away. You know, yesterday, as you say, it was a beautiful day, Easter Sunday. Van der Poel was wearing the Dutch national champions jersey, and all of those factors, I think, played their part. And also, just the fact that the way he is riding it is really an antidote to a lot of the things that frustrate people when they watch road races, the sort of the gamesmanship, brinkmanship, the people waiting for other teams and other riders to do their share of the work. And I think a lot of Van der Poel's attitude is a fruit of the time he's spent and he's still spending in cyclocross and mountain biking, where, you know, it pretty much is full beans from the start of a race to the end. And you know, he doesn't seem to be paying too much heed to what he thinks he should be doing or what tradition dictates he should be doing. And I think that is impressive and is impactful as much as his, well, the obvious physiological ability that he has.
What's kind of telling as well is the response from a lot of his peers. A lot of other riders have commented the last few days on just what a phenomenon he is and how hard he is to race against, which is interesting. We'll hear from Mike Woods in a moment, who did race against him at the Amstel Gold Race, of course. But, I mean, we haven't spoken a lot about Matthew van der Poel. And I said I was at Brabantse Peel last week, where he won in similarly sort of impressive style by, you know, leading out the sprint, doing the things that you're not supposed to do in a road race, which is, you know, like we saw at the Amstel Gold Race, attacking very early with Gorky Zagiri, doing a lot of work in that and getting caught. And then, the decisive move seemed to then go, and he seemed to have missed that, and obviously left with a lot to do in the end. But there's a lot of, obviously, I mean, your tweet hinted at it, Daniel, that there's a lot of hype around Van der Poel, which isn't that surprising. I thought we were going to... I listened to a podcast last week, one of the Bill Simmons podcasts. He was talking about Tiger Woods winning the Masters, and something about the unziggable comment. Are you familiar with this phenomenon? The zig. To quote, I actually wrote it down because it was quite good. Bill Simmons says, there are people out there, they look at the terrain, they study it, and they go, nobody's saying this, so I'm going to make the strongest case to go the other way. It's just been contrary, really. And I guess I'm aware of a lot of hype is the word around Van der Poel. And we haven't really talked about him at all in the podcast, have we? Which is, it feels like a bit of an oversight now, because he
I don't know. I'm kind of sensitive to this, because at the start of the classics season, I kind of said, oh, there's a big jump, big level to go up from the likes of the Dutch National Championship and the European Road Race, where he was on the podium last year. You know, there's a big jump from cyclocross to a 260k classic, and those things still stand. But I think that, you know, once the results and the performances are there for everyone to see and judge, it's fair enough to lavish praise on his performances. But I don't think that I don't think you could really say that this level of performance was coming from just from his dominance of cyclocross or the few performances we've seen on the road from him. I think this spring has really built for him, just from the results that he's had over the last few weeks, from winning the Grand Prix de Nana. I mean, you wouldn't say, oh well, he's won that, so therefore he's now the outright favourite for, you know, to win Amstel Gold in the way that he did. But then fourth at Gent-Wevelgem, where he was lively. Then he won Dwars Door Vlaanderen. I think his ride in the Tour of Flanders was another level, though, where he found himself having to chase back for a long time and was still strong enough to finish fourth. And then, of course, Brabantse Peel. Again, it's not the same level as the Amstel Gold Race, so you have to kind of temper the hype around a rider who doesn't have an awful lot. It's not like you can say, well, this has been building for a season and a half. This is a real explosion onto the scene, and but that doesn't mean that his ride at the Amstel Gold Race wasn't incredibly impressive. I mean, he made what should have been, or could very easily have been, a doomed move early on, and then effectively chased down the breakaway and then led himself out for the sprint. I mean, it was impressive by any measure. But the thing is, he's in a very peculiar situation because of the team that he rides for. You know, yes, they have picked and chosen the races that they'll do for to some extent, but he's got a lot of flexibility and a lot of freedom, really. He hasn't got the pressure of riding for a huge team on his shoulders and almost having to fight to be the designated leader on a particular day. That's a given. He was going to be the designated leader, whether he finished first or 101st. He's raced hard, but relatively lightly. He's done 15 days of road racing this season compared to Alaphilippe's 27. And of course, Alaphilippe crashed in the Basque Country last week. And he's in this weird position now, because how do we place this performance in any kind of context? Because what's he riding next? You know, we can't even say, well, how will he get on now at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, because he's not taking part in that. Which Grand Tours will he do this season? Well, none, probably. So it's a kind of a quirk of the sport, and it's appealing because of that, but it does make it quite hard to sort of pin down and say anything other than this is an extraordinary set of performances now spread over a month of the spring.
I agree with all that. I mean, is it any more extraordinary than Peter Sagan in like, well, 2010, 2011, but 2012, especially when it looked like he was able to win races in this similar way, where it didn't sort of matter if he wasn't tactically so good or if he was outnumbered, or he could just win through sheer strength. And I'm thinking of his stage wins at the Tour de France in particular. But he'd, you know, been he was also younger at the time than Van der Poel is now.
But he had been, well, winning races as a pro, as a road pro, for a couple of years by that point. I mean, I think, yeah. And Van der Poel has also been winning races for a couple of years. But this seems more sudden, doesn't it? And the fact that he's come and been known in another discipline, predominantly, I think that's one of the reasons why people are getting so excited. And, you know, these moments, I sort of think back over the last 15, 20 years, and there have been a few of these moments where you really get the sense that a star is being born in the space of a few hours or the space of one race. I mean, I certainly felt that way about the stage to Arcalis in the 1997 Tour de France. That was also, Jan Ulrich was the winner then, as most people know, and he went on to dominate that Tour de France. I mean, that was also an unusual moment, a unique moment, in the sense that I think it was the last Tour de France that people watched with sort of unbridled, kind of tainted awe, because the next year was the Festina scandal, and then the sort of glasses through which everyone watched the Tour thereafter changed. But there, you know, there was the promise of what might come, and the mind boggled really at what might come. It might have been 5 Tours de France, 10 Tours de France. I think Damiano Cunego winning the Giro in 2004 was similar. And then, Rich, as you say, Sagan was similar in 2010. But you know, the intensity of those moments is no guarantee of the future success. I mean, as we saw with Ulrich and as we saw with Cunego. And, you know, it was interesting you talk about the Brabantse Appeal. That kind of brought this into focus for me this week, because Alaphilippe has started this season looking as though he is going to be unbeatable for the next few years in a certain type of race. And then what happens? A rider comes along who is better than him on a certain type of finish, or certainly was on that day, and looks as though he might be consistently in on this type of course. And all of a sudden, it's no longer a nascent phenomenon. It's someone who is actually might come to be regarded as slightly disappointing. It's so fickle, you know. It's so dependent on who else is around, who else is developing, and at what point they're at in their development.
And what Mathieu van der Poel does, because, you know, what will he do? I know the Tokyo Olympics are a big goal for him. You know, he might go onto the mountain bike for that. He's raced at high level mountain biking as well. He's incredibly versatile. And there is talk as well, certainly in Belgium and Holland, that he could be a Grand Tour rider in the future. But, you know, he'd have to start riding Grand Tours reasonably soon. He's committed to his team for the next couple of years.
I think, Rich, I was looking at this earlier, I think the longest stage race he's ever ridden has been 5 days long. So, yeah, there's a big step up to make there. I mean, just on a sort of physical, physiological level as well. There's this assumption that because he's very inexperienced on the road, or seems to be, he's ridden mostly, or he's had most success in cyclocross, that he will have massive margins of improvement when he finally rides more on the road. And I'm never sure about that, particularly with mountain bikers and cyclocross riders, because they tend to be very good very quickly. And part of the reason for that is the nature of those races, mountain bike races and cyclocross races. You know, we talked about the psychology of a cyclocross race or a mountain bike race, and there's this kind of uninhibited way of racing that, you know, you go to the front and you just off you go, and you're not thinking about what your director's saying or what the time gap is. And, you know, Van der Poel demonstrated that yesterday. But also physically, you know, there was a good piece recently in the French magazine Velo about Van der Poel, and there was a quote in there from Steve Chanel, who's a French cyclocross and road rider. He talked about the differing demands of the two disciplines, and he said that in an average cyclocross race, which lasts an hour, you will do 300 sprints of over 800 watts. And, you know, Mathieu van der Poel has done 33 cyclocross races this winter. That's 10,000 sprints at 800 watts plus. And that's just the races. That's not considering what he's doing in training. Now, is there anyone else in the world tour, I mean, apart from Wout van Aert and you know, other guys who are doing a bit of cyclocross, is there anyone else who's doing that in training? I doubt it. And that obviously breeds and creates different abilities and abilities that are very, very useful in road races. But, you know, if he goes full-time on the road, is he going to continue to do that kind of work? I'm not sure.
Well, that's
interesting. It's a really good point.
It's interesting because obviously it chimes with a period of time when very measurable and shorter, more intense training efforts are, you know, very much in vogue at the moment, aren't they? It's not even a fashion or a fad. It's just the way the understanding of how to train has evolved. You're right. We've talked about this before. You know, is there the possibility that if suddenly Van der Poel was racing, you know, twice as much and doing 7-day stage races and a couple of grand tours, you know, would that take something away from, you know, would there be a sort of detraining element away from what he's currently very good at? It's a fascinating question, and one that we may find out about in the next couple of years. But as you say, Rich, it does look like, you know, his commitment to the Corendon Circus team is being stated quite clearly at the moment. That it's a very small team. There are, I gather, you know, plans to try and get a bit bigger, but the World Tour, there's no spots in the World Tour at the moment, I don't think, for a team to come in, is there? And so the types of racing that he's going to be able to do is going to be compromised a bit, I guess. Although, you know, his name will obviously open some pretty significant doors in 2020, I'd have thought, if he wanted to do stuff.
It's worth dwelling a little bit briefly on the family as well, and that's another reason for, I guess, the excitement and the genes, you would imagine. I mean, we talk about his father, André van der Poel. I you know, he wasn't a rider. I liked a great deal, André van der Poel. I don't really know why, but I got into cycling when he was at his peak, and he wasn't a rider that I really warmed to. But his grandfather Raymond Poulidor, who his athletic gifts are probably overlooked because he's known as the guy who never won. You know, he was the eternal second and came up against Jacques Anquetil for most of his career. But, you know, a great rider who had a very, very long career, won some big races, won the Vuelta, never wore the yellow jersey, of course, but he won the Dauphiné, Paris-Nice, he won Milan-San Remo, he won Flèche Wallonne, won the Grand Prix des Nations, the time trial. So he was a very good rider, you know, and the family genes are almost certainly a significant factor in Van der Poel's ability, you would think.
Well, yeah, I mean, Van der Poel won several classics as well, the Tour of Flanders, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, the Amstel Gold Race himself in 1990. But Adrie van der Poel's brother, Jacques, Matthew's uncle, was also a pro rider. So, you know, the spread of cycling across the family is more than just father and grandfather.
Well, let's hear from a rider who rode Amstel Gold Race and, in fact, was in the move with Kwiatkowski and Matteo Trentin just behind Alaphilippe and Fuglsang. I wonder if that group had come together, they'd have had a better chance of staying away, perhaps. Who knows? But Mike Woods was there for EF Education First. But his big target is Liège-Bastogne-Liège at the weekend. We'll hear from him a bit on that later on. But here's what he had to say about the Amstel Gold Race and Matthew van der Poel.
Well, Mike, I mean, first of all, we saw you in the Amstel Gold Race. You were in that move with Kwiatkowski and Trentin there for a bit. How did that come about and what happened there?
I was feeling really good for Amstel, and the plan was for me to try and cover some of the longer range attacks. However, I just wasn't placed great coming into the base of the climb where Alaphilippe attacked, and was just on the back foot from there. And I had to make a huge effort to get across to Kwiatkowski when I saw him go. And Kwiatkowski managed to bridge up to Trentin, who had been dropped by the Alaphilippe group. And I just caught on as they got together, and I was just on my limit. Tried to stay on and find my legs. However, ended up getting dropped on one of the last climbs of the day. Mm. So had a bit of a walk of shame back to the peloton. But I know we knew that Alberto was going so well after winning Flanders, and Simon was is riding so well at the moment that I obviously wasn't going to win after that move, and had to switch over to try and support them as best as I could. So just tried to drill it for as long as I could.
I mean, it's a funny race where we see even the likes of you in a move with Matteo Trentin. You know, there can't be many races where you and he are in a three-man group together. He's more of a ruler
Then he drops me on a climb.
But these are not maybe the sorts of climbs that you enjoy best.
Well, actually, I enjoy the short ones quite a bit, but just if you're a really smart rider and you're a really strong positioner, it can make a big difference. And obviously, he managed his efforts a lot better than I did, and just managed to lose me on that climb.
What do you make of Matthew van der Poel? How much of him did you see yesterday, and what do you make of not just his performances but the way that he rides?
Oh, it's incredible. That performance yesterday was one of those performances that you go back to the dinner table afterwards and you talk to the guys at the table, and everyone's just taken aback, like, just super impressive. One of those amazing sporting achievements, and one of the reasons why I got into competing in sports as a kid. You just see these amazing athletes perform these incredible feats, and it gets you excited and makes you think more of the magic of sport. And yeah, just incredible.
He's always done road racing, and he comes from a road racing family, but he's done a lot of other things as well. And I wondered if, you know, you came to road racing quite late as well, and from another sport. Is there a sort of honeymoon period when you switch from another discipline where you're, you know, it's all kind of fresh and new, and you're constantly surprising yourself and gaining sort of momentum from that?
I definitely think that's certainly the case. There's certainly a mental boost to just not being weighed back, like held back by previous experience. I remember talking to Mitch Docker about this, actually, one of our veteran guys on our team, and he talked about how it's been nice having newer guys on the team, just because they do stuff that, if you're an older pro, you kind of get hardened and you kind of get bit a couple times, and you start thinking, I'm not going to make this attack because I've learned in the past that I can't. And so potentially you set limits on yourself that maybe on that day you weren't as good as the day you are where you could make that move. He doesn't have those inhibitions, Van der Poel, at the moment, and it's exciting to watch. I mean, he attacked with 45k to go yesterday and put everybody on the back foot, and even being in the race, it was exciting for me. I thought it was super cool to see, and it made it that much more fun for me in the race.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Well, the voice of Seb Piquet interrupts this week's episode. Seb Piquet, of course, the voice of Race Radio at the Tour de France, to remind me to tell you that this week's episode is supported by Harry's Razors. Now, that Harry's have a special offer for Cycling Podcast listeners, a trial set for just £3.95. And all you have to do to get that is go to harrys.com/cycling. But Lionel, in last month's or this month's Cycling Podcast Femina, Rose Manley really raised the bar when it came to the Harry's advert. She performed, I think perform is not an exaggeration, a haiku. Can you emulate that at all?
Well, Rich, I was inspired by Rose's haiku, short poem, isn't
who
it?
Who wasn't?
Well, of course. I mean, it was inspirational. But I'm much more of a limerick man, you know. So I've written a limerick.
Brilliant.
Not had a lot of notice to come up with a limerick, or to, you know, you challenged me to match Rose's haiku. So this is what I've come up with. There was a young man called Rich whose stubble began to itch. His favourite shaver is a money saver. Harry's razors are the ones for our Rich. How about that?
Goodness me. I think Rose is still safe. I think her haiku's...
well, there's an intellectual element to the haiku.
More that, literary merit.
Yeah, I mean, the limerick is very much...
A lower art form.
It is a lower art form, but no, none the worse for that, I think.
Bit more creativity in yours, because she literally just reeled off the things that you get in your trial set, which is a weighted ergonomic handle, 5 precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and travel blade cover. And you as a listener to the Cycling Podcast can get all that for just £3.95 by going to harrys.com/cycling. That's harrys.com/cycling if Lionel's limerick has tempted you to try the Harry's trial set.
I met Bernie for a ride. It was actually our second ride. Super weather, everything was nice, and had a good chat there. And suddenly this car pops out, you know. Immediately I knew it was a bad crash, because it was really like you hit the wall, you know.
Yeah.
This car come out, and then in the last moment it ceases again, like, and stops. Because if it continues, also Bernie goes in. Well, but then luckily everything worked pretty well. I actually even have a photo, you know, of this thing. It was pretty nasty stuff. We were supposed to go straight on, and it came out of the junction. It came from
you
here.
You come in here?
No, we went down.
Okay, this way.
And I just hit in here with the knee, and then sliding this way, because it was in a kind of an angle. Yeah. And then on this border, you say, yeah?
Yeah.
My knee probably...
And where was Bernie? Was he on this side or that side?
He was on the left, and he just managed to go around in front, like, by centimetres.
Well, that was a little trailer for an imminent friend special, which I listened to yesterday, Daniel. I don't know, do we have a title for it yet? But it follows Mark O'Haller and Bernie Eisel as they recovered from very serious injuries last year.
Not sure we've got a title yet, Rich.
But tell us a bit about it, Daniel, because you've been following both of them for a year, essentially.
Yes. So Mark O'Haller and Bernie Eisel were out training near Klagenfurt, where they live, last April, just after Paris-Roubaix. So it's exactly a year ago. And Marco was hit by a car, had a terrible, sustained a terrible knee injury. At one point, it looked as though they might have to amputate his left leg. And it was obvious from the start that he faced a very long recovery process. And we decided to accompany him on that recovery process. Parallel to that, Bernhard Eisel had crashed in Tirreno Adriatico. He seemed to be fine. He was with Marco on the day that he crashed in training. But he was also experiencing headaches at that time. And just the day after Marco's crash, in fact, Bernie went into hospital, and the doctors saw that he had a hematoma on his brain, and his brain had moved about 8 millimeters out of or from its center, and he was in a pretty bad way, and he had to stop cycling immediately with no real date or idea about when he would be able to start racing and riding again. So it was a long journey for both of them, and it culminated quite nicely with Paris-Roubaix last week, and certainly for Marco that was a really good day, with Niels Pollitt finishing second and Marco himself riding well to finish 16th, I think. So yeah, it's a year-long journey that we follow them on, a very intimate look at the process of recovering from serious injury, I think.
And it's a cracking listen, highly recommended. So yeah, so any more takeaways from the Amstel Gold Race before we move on to the two Ardennes classics, Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège?
Well, Rich, the course was different this year, wasn't it, at Amstel Gold? And I thought it was a vast improvement. I was never a big fan of either iterations of the previous two iterations of the Amstel course, the one finishing on the Kalberg and the one finishing just beyond it. And I thought yesterday was much more in keeping with the character, the finale yesterday, the finish was much more in keeping with the character of the rest of the race, which is small roads. Positioning is absolutely key. This is also one reason why Van der Poel might have excelled yesterday, that he's certainly very adept and as we just discussed, probably physiologically very well adapted to, you know, those little sprints that move you up and take you around a corner and so forth. But I thought that it looked great, and I thought that it made for very interesting racing.
Yeah, I'd certainly say that the last sort of 5-10 kilometres were racing really without any influence from external factors. By that I mean getting information about what was happening behind or in front of them would have been very difficult, and that explains why Alaphilippe and Fuglsang were caught quite as cold as they were, first by Kwiatkowski and then obviously by the bigger group led by Van der Poel. But I also think, just before we move on, Alaphilippe was in a funny position, wasn't he? Because you would say he would be absolutely hot favourite to beat Fuglsang in any circumstances in a two-up finish like that. Fuglsang had tried that little move, which probably got into Alaphilippe's head a little bit. That broke up the cooperation between the two of them to some extent. And Alaphilippe maybe was overthinking it a bit. Sometimes the simplest problem in front of you becomes more complicated when there's time to think about it. And as the seconds ticked by and he started overthinking it, it wasn't theirs to decide what was happening after that.
We've got a very familiar finish this week with Flèche Wallonne, obviously, up the Mur de Huy, and then another changed finish to Liège-Bastogne-Liège, which may have may make the race significantly different this year. Flèche Wallonne first. I mean, it's a point that Dan Lloyd made on Twitter. He noticed that this was the first time that Alejandro Valverde at the Amstel Gold Race had finished outside the top 50 in any race for quite some time, supporting my claims a few weeks ago that he's a fading force, perhaps. But he's always a favourite up at the Mur de Huy at Flèche Wallonne, although Alaphilippe won it last year. As Daniel said, a long week for Alaphilippe non-fans. I mean, do we expect him to win at Flèche Wallonne, and what are we expecting from Liège as well?
I think he will win on the Mur de Huy, Rich. It's a climb that once a rider kind of gets the hang of, if they're strong enough, they tend to win again and again, as we've seen with Valverde. And I think Alaphilippe cracked it last year, and I think he'll be the strongest rider again. The one sort of unknown quantity, different threat he'll face from last year is Schachmann for Bora Hansgrohe, who has been exceptional on the short steep finishes this year.
You reckon he's quite chunky, Schachmann, is he? And he went pretty close at the Amstel Gold Race. You think it's not too steep for him, the Mur de Huy?
He was eighth last year, so, you know, just in the little group just behind Alaphilippe and Valverde. So,
And he was a teammate of Alaphilippe as well last year, so would have been on slightly different duties. But yeah, no, I mean, he's a good, Bora Hansgrohe could have quite a strong team in these two races, you would think. We've not mentioned Peter Sagan, but he had a disappointing Amstel Gold race, and it's his kind of less heralded teammates who are performing so well for that team at the moment.
And Rich, they'll have, yeah, as you say, they will have a decent team. Liège in particular with them. I think Formolo is going to be riding there. He's had some good results in the past in that race. And could it be time? Is it time for the top 18 rundown?
Oh, go for it.
This is very bold, coming before we've seen, you know, the runners and riders and how they get on at Flèche Wallonne. But go ahead.
Well, I've seen the start list, Napa. I've seen a provisional start list. Top 18 riders most likely to win Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Surnames only. This list will not be repeated or published. Alaphilippe, Kwiatkowski, Valverde, Martin, Fuglsang, Schachmann, Adam Yates, Peter Sagan, Michael Matthews, Nibali, Wellens, Dumoulin, Bardet, Lutsenko, Woods, Jungels, Poles, Toynes. There you go. There you go, chaps.
I was interested. Bardet in there. He rode well at the Amstel Gold Race, didn't he? Making that group. But with this new finish, you know, he got away last year with Mike Woods in the finale on these tough roads. The new finish, is it going to suit a climber like that?
Well, there's this assumption, Rich, because it's the race is no longer finishing on a climb. There's an assumption that it's going to be less selective. I think the opposite is going to be true, because I think the race has been a little bit sort of sterile and it's been sort of neutralized until the last 20 or 30 kilometers in the past few years, in the expectation of those final, well, particularly the final two climbs, breaking everything up. And I think, well, whenever we see a new route, and I think this was actually a factor in Amstel as well, the first couple of editions, there is more aggressive racing because there's that uncertainty. People don't know where the X is that marks the spot where the race always sort of decants and comes to life, and that will be the case in Liège. And also I just think that people will be more aggressive. It opens the race to more riders and you know, who would previously have been intimidated by that finish.
Yeah, there's around 15 kilometres from the top of the final climb, the Côte de la Rochefoucauld, to the finish in Liège. So, what, around about 20 minutes of racing. Well,
but it keeps going up a fair bit, doesn't it, after the top of that?
It's not going to be flat, is it? But then once you get into the suburbs of Liège and what have you, it does narrow down. I mean, you could see a small group which would have some obvious better sprinters than others. I mean, when you were reading out your list there, I don't know what number Adam Yates came in or Mike Woods specifically, but you know, they're the sort of riders who you would imagine if they were in a group with, say, Peter Sagan or Julian Alaphilippe, they're going to be racing for the relatively minor places, aren't they? That's the conundrum, and that the distance from the final set piece climb to the finish does mean that it might be a sort of Tour of Flanders type finish, where it's sort of groups chasing and it all comes down to who is committed and who isn't. And as we always see, riders who get their noses in front and have a little bit of daylight between them and the group behind, once they've committed fully, it puts the doubt into the chasers' minds, and then it comes down to a question of, well, there's six riders here, all from six different teams. Who's going to work? Who's going to save their legs? And it becomes a game of bluff, a game of cat and mouse. And I think it will probably end up like that.
What was Tom Dumoulin on your list?
He was, Rich, 12th.
He was.
Yeah,
right. I Michael Matthews as well.
Yeah, Matthews down in 9th. I mean, all of my sort of top four fast finishers, Alaphilippe, Kwiatkowski, Valverde, Martin, but I don't think, you know, Matthews and Sagan are the only two that really belong in a different category, the sort of sprinter puncher types rather than the punchers and the climbers.
Just a bit of breaking news. A press release has just dropped this second from the CCC team, saying that Greg Van Avermaet is adding Liège-Bastogne-Liège to his race programme. Now, back at Kern Brussels Kern, I asked Jim Okovic whether this would be the plan, because, you know, you would think that if with the new finish, if it suits Peter Sagan, it would suit Greg Van Avermaet. And, well, he wasn't too bad at the weekend. He was in that chase group at Amstel Gold. So he says he's decided
to line
up.
Too late to make Daniels 18, unfortunately. That'll be a blow to him.
19th, I guess.
Yeah. Shall we hear from a rider who was second last year at Liège-Bastogne-Liège? A real breakthrough performance for him. Michael Woods, again. We heard his thoughts on the Amstel Gold race. Here's what he makes of Liège-Bastogne-Liège this weekend and the new finish in particular.
A huge result for you last year. A huge performance and result for you last year. You must look back on that as a moment where you sort of maybe felt that you arrived, did you?
Yeah, I certainly, it was the biggest result of my career at that point. And it was a special moment for me. At right around the time my wife's father started getting very sick, and he ultimately passed away a month later, and we needed some good news back home. And yeah, it was like just a special day for a lot of reasons. And it's got me excited for this week to come. JV, when he signed me on this team, his big goal was to have me do well at the Ardennes Classics, and I think that was kind of confirmation of his belief in me last year. And so I kind of want to keep on performing here now.
And you mentioned that you're staying in a hotel at the bottom of La Redoute. It's a different course this year. What do you make of the new course? Is it one that suits you? And that climb in particular, it could be quite crucial. Are you intending to ride up and down that several times this week?
Yeah, for sure. I'm a big fan of visualization. I like seeing courses. I like studying them. I like looking over Google Maps and just getting an idea of how they're going to play out. So I'll certainly be riding up and down it. But I think quite a few people are saying this is going to be an easier course. And really, in World Tour racing, the course is rarely, like, the course isn't what truly defines how hard a race is. It's how we ride it. And by virtue of the courses being the hills being a bit earlier before the final, I think guys are just gonna start riding harder. You're gonna look at guys like Alaphilippe, who did an early attack this past Sunday, and quite a few other guys like Fuglsang are gonna have to attack early, and it's gonna make for a much more challenging race. And even last year with Colan, like within a final climb in place, it was still a very reduced group going into that final. So I don't see it being, I still being a real tough race.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to our longtime sponsors, Science in Sport, for their support of the Cycling Podcast. It is very much appreciated. You can still get 25% off all your Science in Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25 to load up on gels, bars, drinks, etc. for your summer bike riding, because it feels like summer already. Keep your questions coming as well for the Science and Sport experts. We're building up a bit of a stock of questions to put to Ben Samuels at Science and Sport, and we'll hear some of his answers to your questions over the coming weeks and at the Giro d'Italia in particular, as well as emailing us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. You can leave a WhatsApp voice memo at +447971338205. That's +447971338205. Leave a voice message on WhatsApp there with your question for Science and Sport. Well, a bit of news that almost passed us by last week, because it happened in Mexico and there's an awful lot of racing going on, was Victor Campenaerts breaking Bradley Wiggins' hour record. I was at Brabantse Peel where his Lotto Soudal team were competing, and I spoke to the general manager, Marc Sargeant, about Campenaerts' new record and about the support that the team had given him in his quest to break that record. Were you tempted to go over to Mexico?
I was tempted, but in this period it's quite busy in Belgium also, so we had a good team there, so I was supported maximum.
a big investment then by the team in his preparation and in the attempt itself. Was that a difficult decision? Because the team's obviously got an awful lot of other targets as well.
That's true, but 2 years ago when I gave him a phone call to join us, I promised him we're going to make a real project around you to make you a better time trialist than you are now. And that's what we did step by step. And when he asked me, I think it was in August last year, Mark, I have a special question. I want to go 2 months in Namibia, January, February. I said, why? I have a few friends, triathletes, and they always go to that place and it should be great and I want to try it. Okay, I said, I trust you, you can do it. But that was August. And then he did the Vuelta with Thomas de Gendt. And Thomas, he was the whole Vuelta, he was like, why don't you try to break the hour record? You can do that. So every day. And then he went to the Worlds. First he wanted to give up the last week in the Vuelta. And I said, no, you cannot give up. You have to go and continue because you have to be a better bike rider than you are now. Not a time trialist, but also a bike rider. And he finished and he ended up third at a few hundredths of the second place. And in the meantime, he had the idea, which Thomas de Gendt was pointing out all the time. And after the Worlds, he did a test on the track in Grenchen, half an hour. And he had a little bit more than the hour record of Wiggins. And if you see that, then for him it was like, I'm going to give it a try. And it's a good moment because I have already 2 months, which I gave him. And then I do the Tirreno Adriatico. I go back on altitude in Mexico. And the skills to do it on the track, he still had to learn because he's not a track specialist. So he was there especially not only for the altitude, but also for the habit of the track. And it worked out pretty well.
I mean, I watched the Belgian news last night. It was big news in Belgium. There's a lot of history around their record with Eddy Merckx and so on. So what does it mean to the team?
Well, we had a lot of publicity already up front because they were talking about his altitude camp, the bike, of course, every detail. Sometimes it was 2 pages, the whole bike in pieces. So the sponsors were quite happy with already that. But of course, the closer it comes, the more you feel the pressure also, it has to work. And it was a big relief that he broke it. And on top of that, he went above 55. So that was, for me, really great. And I think the investment paid off.
And when he comes back, you'll get him back into road action soon. What will be his first race on the road?
It will be difficult, I think, to get him out of this... I call it a trance or a
the bubble that
he's for sure he's in a sort of bubble now, and let's enjoy him a little bit because he deserves it. But he will come back and do Romandy and Giro.
So that was Mark Sargeant reflecting on Campenaerts' success. They haven't had an awful lot of success, Lotto Soudal, although Caleb Ewan was in good form at the Tour of Turkey, getting a couple of wins there in quite unconventional fashion. And it does seem, I mean, a lot of Lotto Soudal's wins and things do come in quite unconventional fashion, I guess. So that seems appropriate.
I listened to old Adam Blythe's interview with Thijs Benoot the other day, chaps. Very interesting that was. Benoot's not riding Liège.
He's injured still, is he not? I mean, he had quite a nasty crash at Paris-Roubaix. So I think that's ruled him out.
Shame. They've still got Wellens, of course.
Yeah, and Wellens looks in good form, but how he converts that into a win is the eternal question, isn't it? I mean, yeah, but Brabantse Peel was interesting because Wellens won that last year, of course, and he was in that leading group with Matthew van der Poel and Michael Matthews, who on paper was the fastest finisher there. But he made so many efforts on the climbs. Matthews, he was also sort of boxed in a bit at the finish, that he wasn't able to really contest the sprint, and that's always the danger that a rider like him he has his sort of sharp edge blunted a bit by all the efforts that come before. That might be a fear for him going into Liège, Bastogne-Liège, but he's probably going to win it now with me having said that. Before we go on, I should mention once again the mugs that I mentioned last week, cycling podcast mugs produced by friend of the podcast, Stacey Snyder. These will go on sale in limited edition during the Giro, the Tour and the Vuelta, different colour schemes for each race, and they will raise money for a good cause. We've had a lot of nominations already for good causes, some great nominations. They can be a cycling club, a junior race, I don't know, anything at all, cycling related preferably. Please email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, if you'd like to nominate a good cause. And all the proceeds from the sales of the mugs will go to the good cause. And thanks very much, Stacey Snyder. The mugs look absolutely magnificent. And we'll be giving you more details about how to get them and how much they'll cost soon. But they will be able to be shipped all around the world. It's quite expensive to send them some places. So postage and packing costs may be quite significant. But we will give you the full details as soon as we have them. What more news, chaps?
Well, I wondered what you made of Rod Ellingworth's decision to leave Team Sky, Team Ineos, as they will become in a couple of weeks' time, to go to Bahrain Merida. When exactly is that happening? Do you guys know?
I understand it will happen for next season. And Rod will not start working for the team before 2020 officially. But I don't think he'll see out the season with Team Sky either. I think that he will, his employment with them will end sooner than
he's,
that.
He's going to have a lovely garden. He's going to have a lovely garden by the end of the autumn, isn't he?
yeah. I mean, quite a big job now. That was a team that really looked like it was clicking through the gears last year, but this year, like Team Sky until today with friend of the podcast Theo Gegenhardt winning at the Tour of the Alps, they've had a bit of a shocker this year so far. Not so many results. We'll be expecting a lot from Nibali at the Giro, I guess. But Rohan Dennis has been pretty invisible, and Matej Moric has been riding the classics, but not really built so far yet on his success last year. So quite a big job. But you mentioned in your news roundup, Lionel, that the McLaren involvement is key to Ellingworth joining Bahrain Merida, and I understand that's the case, that he will be effectively employed by McLaren, so they could be stepping up their involvement in the team as well.
I think it is a big job, Rich. I mean, I expect that Rod is going to have more responsibility at Bahrain than he had at Sky, although he's a very important figure at Sky. But, yeah, there are a few things that I'm sure they'll want to address there. Who is going to be their Grand Tour leader? Because I think Nibali is probably going to leave and go to Trek Segafredo. You would imagine that they would want a project, an individual that they can really sort of work on over the next couple of years. Rohan Dennis has certainly shown some promise as a general classification rider, but not to the extent where they wouldn't want someone else, I don't think. Just on Rod Ellingworth, chaps, as well, it went under the radar to a large extent, but it was quite an important week last week for one of his old protégés, Mark Cavendish, who didn't win a stage of the Tour of Turkey, but he was third on one stage. I saw him a few days before he left for Turkey in Mallorca, actually, and there were fairly encouraging signs, I thought, about his health, first and foremost. As we know, he's on this sort of long process of recovery, having suffered from Epstein-Barr virus for the last couple of years. He was certainly pretty sure that he wasn't going to have any more health problems in the near future. And he was training well, and I think he knows, and people are telling him that he just needs to be patient now and keep working hard, and not panic if the results don't come immediately. But I was quite heartened by certainly a couple of the interviews, or one of the interviews he gave after that third place in Turkey, where he looked very sprightly and he looked very happy to be sort of back in the mix.
Well, we should wrap things up there, fellas. There's been a lot going on. It feels like there's a lot more to talk about, but we'll probably return to things like Sam Bennett, the Tour of Turkey at some point.
Well, yeah, it's always the way, isn't it? The classics, you know, sort of gallop through the classics weekend by weekend, and then just a small pause for breath before the Grand Tours start. So it's always the way. But before we go, Rich, I should just say, ask about your secret side project that hit the airwaves this past week, the Women's Cycling Show. Your first foray into television. I'm going to have to start calling you Television's Richard Moore.
This
is a spin-off of
it was like hostage TV. I was forced into it by Orla Shinoui and Rose Manley, but it was fun, as you say, a first effort. Who knows whether there'll be another one.
Well, so it's a pilot, basically a video spin-off of the Cycling Podcast Feminin. And if you want to watch it, it is on our YouTube channel. The Cycling Podcast has a YouTube channel, and that's the best place to catch episode one of the Women's Cycling Show.
Rich, now when people ask you what you do for a living, do you say, I'm a YouTuber?
Well, no, because there's no living to be made by it at this point. Daniel, watch this space. Who knows? No, I don't think so. I don't think that's where my future lies. You know, keeping all options open at the moment, everything remains on the table. Let's see if there'll be a further episode. But it was fun, and there's definitely space for that, I think, covering women's cycling. So yeah. We'll furnish you with more details when we have them.
You're being modest. I thought it was very good, Rich. I thought even you were very good in it.
Oh, great. Well, let's leave it there. Before we go, let's say our thank yous, as is now customary, to the friends of the podcast, some of the friends of the podcast. We're going to work through as many as we can over the course of the year. But a big thank you to Niels Madsen, to Rebecca Gates, Rod McEwen, Jeffrey Milligan, Gary Hadfield, and Henry Taylor.
And thank you to Matthew Dakin, Andrew McMeeking, Eamon Coughlin, Thomas Ehlenfeld, Jennifer Meller, and Richard Pinch.
And a big thank you to Kenneth Rogers, Paul Bailey, Jeremy Rouenet, I hope that's correct, Stephen Tunstall, Alexa Cartwright, and Eric Nesters Matheson. Big thank you to all of you for supporting the Friends of the Podcast. Your support helps us to go and cover the Grand Tours, which are coming up very soon. Giro d'Italia starts on the 11th of May, I think it is.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chap.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.